Welcome to Ask an Artist. I'm Laura Boswell.
And I'm Peter Keegan. And as always, we are under the watchful eye of the very talented Mr. B.
We are indeed. And as you probably know by now, we are taking a little break at the moment. But we're not leaving you high and dry. We have some of our very favourite episodes to replay during the time that we're away. And Mr. B is featuring in this week's episode because we're going to look at taking good photographs of your 2D artwork using the kind of kit you've got lying around at home. And that's really important, isn't it, Peter?
That's right. Yeah, us artists need high quality photographs to show us at our best. And we need people like the talented Mr. B. He's called talented Mr. B for a reason. We let him out of the cupboard, didn't we, Laura? We thought now's the time to drag him out and pick his brains exactly how to make our artwork look that little bit better, picking his brains on positioning, work on the wall and which camera. And can you really take a good photograph using an iPhone or a simple telephone, or do you have to have all the whiz-bang equipment? And I was fascinated that you don't need all that techie stuff. You could do something really quite simple with basic means and materials, or you could go the full way and get the whole studio. So we picked his brains fully on that best way to go about taking that. And I think this is quite good for you because you're doing something on photography soon, aren't you?
That's absolutely right. We've got a demonstration on Zoom. The talented Mr. B is going to craft all these homemade lighting and prop sets to use with the phone to take photographs of the work. And he's going to do that on Zoom. So, yeah, you can book a place on that course through my website at lauraboswell.co.uk. And that kicks off on the 11th of April, that Zoom show. So now I've shamelessly plugged Mr. B. Let's turn to you, Peter. So what are you up to at the moment?
Well, I'm enjoying this rather beautiful spell of sunshine that we're having in spring because I've been in my back garden sitting in this warm, welcome sunshine, sitting amongst my favourite springtime flower, the daffodil. I just love daffodils. That's possibly
well,
me hankering
Welsh.
After my Welsh identity. Absolutely. I'm just sort of, it's the national flower of Wales and I do love it. But I really do love that optimistic splash of rich gold and yellow they give the garden. They're literally trumpeting and announcing the coming of spring. But then a problem occurs. Which tube of paint do I turn to help me paint this rich golden yellow? Do I choose cadmium yellow? Perhaps. Yellow ochre? Too dark. Lemon yellow? Too light. No. I turn to Michael Harding's cadmium golden yellow. And it does exactly what it says on the tin, or in this case, on the paint tube, because it has all the bright, strong tinting powers of a regular cadmium yellow, but with the special added unique shade of deep golden yellow orange as found in the humble daffodil. Now, cadmium golden yellow is a cadmium sulfide colour that has a high tinting power that bridges the yellows and oranges of the colour wheel and works particularly well when mixed with other earth-based colours such as ochres, browns and mid-reds, making it an ideal colour for plein air landscape painters or still life artists. So if you're looking to paint your very own host of golden daffodils, then you can't do much better than adding Michael Harding's glorious cadmium golden yellow.
Yeah, that sounds like a gorgeous colour, Peter. So if you'd like to find out more about this vibrant yellow and the other colours offered by Michael Harding, why not visit his website? It's michaelharding.co.uk. And now we've had our little chat and introduced you to Peter's beautiful daffodil yellow, let's get on with listening to that recording about photography. Hi, I'm Laura Boswell.
And I'm Peter Keegan, and over there is the talented Mr. B on sound.
Welcome to Ask an Artist, the podcast that will help you take the leap and become a working artist, the sort that actually gets to make art and pay the bills at the same time. Every week, Peter and I will be sharing our experience on everything from the best way to approach a gallery, how to price your work, to how to deal with criticism, and much more besides. Not only will we share our thoughts on these, but we'll be interviewing some of the best experts in the business, all with the aim of making art your proper job.
Now, one thing that almost all artists need to do, no matter what media they work in, is to photograph their art. A good snap of your creation often offers the very first impression of both your art and professionalism. In this Instagrammable social media age, we thrive on crisp, engaging and inspiring images of our work, not to mention the possibilities of selling your work based solely on how it looks in a photo. But is there a knack to photographing art? And is there anything you can do to make your photographs better? This week, we're joined by professional photographer and very special guest, the talented Mr. B, or as he likes to be called, Ben Boswell, who's swapping his audio editing chair for the interviewing chair. So, hello, Ben.
Hi, Peter.
You finally get the name Ben as opposed to the talented Mr. B.
I don't mind. I answer to pretty much anything.
And how does it feel being this side of the mic instead of watching Laura and I rabbit away about arty stuff?
Very nerve-wracking.
It's not as easy as it looks, I can tell you. It's a lot harder, isn't it, Laura?
So it is, yes. You need to be a real professional to do these podcasts.
I'll do my best.
I think it's also important at this point to note that you are, of course, the very fortunate husband of an artist, Laura Boswell, who's sitting next to me right now.
Yep, that's the case. I've been married to Laura for over 30 years now.
And how does it feel being married to not just the Laura Boswell, but a working artist and everything that entails?
Yeah, to be honest, it's better being married to the Laura Boswell.
Though poor Ben has had to, over the years, find many skills to help me out as an artist, and photography is certainly one of them.
Well, that's not entirely true. I was doing the photography before I knew Laura, but I have taught myself a number of different things over the years to support Laura.
Run off a few of the, you know, as a sort of right-hand man to an artist, what are some of the things that Laura makes you do all the time?
Well, I'm her taxi driver, her delivery man, her framer, her photographer.
You wrap up and send orders.
Yes, I'm the postal clerk. I make bits of presentation machinery like card racks and all sorts of stuff like that.
Are you a critic to the work, dare I ask?
Yes, I am. Sometimes I see things that Laura's doing and I say that I don't think it's working. But I'm usually seeing it very, very early in the process. So
I think actually your better criticism comes when I'm thinking of a project, because quite often if I have a series of prints or something in mind, I'll chat to Ben about it and we'll talk through whether we think the project will work well.
So you will bounce ideas off
the absolutely, yeah. And I do trust his judgment. He's got a very good sense of what makes for a suitable series of prints and things. So there is that kind of having somebody on hand who's sensitive to my work and really helpful at discussing it,
which I think is handy anyway to have. Yeah, have that person, you whether it's, you know, yeah, a partner, spouse or friend.
But you do this with your wife too.
Yeah, Kimberly's very good. She can tell that, you know, I could be kidding myself saying, oh, this painting's really, really good, and she'll look at it and she'll go, oh, okay then, and I go, what do you mean
the mistress of understatement.
Yeah, and you know, she'll say, oh, like, that bit's not quite up to, you know, your usual standard, and I'll be, what, you're talking nonsense, don't be so silly. But she's absolutely right. She knows that. I think it's because they know your work and they know you inside out as well. And they've seen that development and sort of process over the years. So it must be really fascinating to see how Laura's developed as an artist, particularly coming into it later on in life, Ben.
I think Laura's always been artistically inclined, even when she wasn't actually producing artwork. But her outlets were many and varied. She did embroidery and she did a number of different things. But when she went back to art, she really picked it up and ran with it.
Mm. And you could see her blossom and sort of flourish.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So tell us then, so you are a professional photographer. That's your sort of your background and training? Because I know you're part of a bit of a photography sort of legacy and artistic dynasty, aren't you?
I'm sure my father would absolutely love to feel that he was the start of a dynasty. My father was a professional photographer. He's still alive, but he doesn't take many pictures anymore.
What's his name?
Brian Shull. Mm-hmm. Brian was a jobbing photographer. He did a lot of PR work, editorial advertising work, all sorts of different things. Worked for Sainsbury's. He worked for various advertising agencies, a number of different places. And he taught me how to use a camera very early on. And I have to say that when I look at my pictures, I see his pictures in every grain of every picture.
I think you both have a very sensitive ability to observe people and to capture what they're doing without being invasive.
Well, I hope so. That's really what I want to be doing. I have to put my hand up here and say that whilst this episode is going to be talking about the need for photographing your own work in a way that represents it well to galleries or to customers, that isn't the kind of photography that I do day to day. What I do day to day is to photograph people at work, a kind of editorial portraiture that aims to show the way that people interact with their materials and with their processes.
So specifically, I should say that your specialism is really potters and ceramics, isn't it?
I've certainly done more on potters and ceramicists than anything else, but I would say that my specialism is people who make stuff because I'm utterly fascinated by the processes that go to make up the end product. I love to record the process that is the backstory of a piece of art or a piece of craft. It just thrills me, and it also, I believe, helps people to sell their work. But that kind of photography is very specific, and it's very difficult to do it for yourself. It's something that is easier to get somebody to come in and photograph you doing what you do rather than...
I can relate to that. I find it very difficult to take a photograph of myself at work whilst I'm holding a paintbrush and a
palette
at the same time.
Yes. And
often the people I'm photographing, they're up to their elbows in clay and slip and all sorts of stuff. And the idea of handling a piece of photographic equipment at that time is really not a very good idea. So I have made this specialism of photographing people in that kind of context.
But it's interesting, isn't it, how sensitive editorial photography, rather than the sort of traditional studio setup, is actually a far more powerful tool for a maker for selling their work, because it invites people into their world and their studio as a maker and kind of tells the backstory about making art.
I absolutely agree. It's very important to try and take that kind of photography in as uncontrolled a way as possible. So the best photography of that style is recording what it was actually like. Photography is very rarely reality. It's representing a version of reality. It's making an interpretation. But the closer you can get to reality in your pictures, the better it is. And what we're going to be talking about today, the photography of pieces of art, that's the same, but for photographing pieces of art, the requirement is quite different, because rather than going in and seeing a painting or a print or a drawing on a wall and photographing it in the available light that was there, for this kind of photography, you have to have control. You have to be able to light it properly, and you have to be able to photograph it square on.
Okay, so can you share with us then why us artists need to photograph our work well, and what purposes and use would we do with these photographs of our paintings and prints and pots and jewellery? Why do artists need to take good photos, and what will they use them for?
Well, the most important thing is to be able to show other people what you've done. And that can be anybody. It can be your following on social media. It can be a gallery that you're dealing with. It can be somebody that has contacted you and wants to see a painting that you've done or a print that you've done, and you just need to email them a picture.
So it would be fair to say, in this instance, we're not talking about the photograph as an interpretation. We're talking about the photograph as an accurate record.
Absolutely.
Which is very different from the kind of studio photography we were talking about before.
When you say studio photography, that's slightly ambiguous.
Well,
but
all right, photography in an
of people
studio.
In a studio, yeah. In their own studio, yeah. Or workshop is one thing, and that can be atmospheric and lovely and make you feel good. But this kind of photography of your actual work, you have to strip out everything other than what the picture actually looks like. So you need to make sure that the colours are right, for instance.
That's especially true, isn't it, Peter? If you're selling a piece based on a photograph, the client is going to be very unhappy if the piece arrives and it's not what they've seen.
Yes, and a lot of gallery dealers also say the same thing, haven't they? That they get sent a lot of email photographs of here what the paintings, and the dealer will kind of make a judgment based on what they see digitally. And then if you as the artist turn up and they do look completely different, the blue is a completely different colour blue to what you've said it is, that's going to have a huge professional impact on whether the gallery decides to work with you and whether any client will, you know, buy your work. So it is about being accurate and sincere to what you've produced.
The reality of the situation is that if you get the colour wrong, then either you won't sell the picture because they'll look at the picture in the photograph and it will look wrong, or you'll photograph the picture, the gallery will like it in the picture, and then when they see it in reality, they won't like it and you won't sell it. So essentially, this is a deal breaker. If you don't get it right, you won't sell your work. And that's the bottom line.
We should also say, especially true of competitions, there's no point taking a photograph of your work and then zhuzhing it up in Photoshop to look really, really good, and then it not being accurate to the original.
Absolutely.
So what Ben's going to do, he's going to share exactly how to photograph a work sort of from start, middle and end.
So what I'm actually going to do, I would love to be able to talk to you for a few minutes and for you then to have enough information to go away and take your own pictures and not have to work through the problems that you're going to come across. However, that's not really realistic. What is realistic is that I can tell you the things that you need to consider in taking a photograph, and I can tell you how to go about starting to resolve those.
So shall we ask you a series of questions? That's probably the
best way
forward.
I think that's the best way.
So let's begin with the camera.
Right. Well, I've never been much of a camera geek. I don't really care. You know, cameras are, all of them, just machines for capturing pictures. And I am absolutely happy to work with the camera that I work with at the moment, which is a big Nikon, or with a little compact camera, or with my phone. They're all fine. They're all cameras, and they all do the same job. So I don't mind what camera you use. The only advantage of using a proper camera is that you have a lot more control. And having control in a situation where you need to adjust colour, for instance, is a big deal. Because if you don't have control, then the camera's making the decision about what the colour of your picture is. And that's all done automatically. You don't really have any way of changing that.
So we'll come on to colour correction and things in a minute. So assuming that you have a camera or a phone, what sort of lighting? Because we are always a sort of, as a, I know myself, when I think of photography like this, I'm always thinking, oh my goodness, you need a big lighting kit and getting everything perfect. Is that true?
It's true up to a point. It's very, very difficult to take good copy pictures of your artwork.
Can I just interrupt you? Copy picture, what does that...
All right. Well, this kind of photography in the industry is called copy work, and it's to do with taking realistic and accurate pictures of an artwork. In order to do that, you have to light the subject evenly. You need to be able to get the same exposure right from corner to corner. Because if it's dark on one side and light on the other, that will show in the pictures. So you need a minimum of two lights, really. And those lights need to match. They need to have the same output and they need to be the same colour. What we've discovered recently are that if you go to a DIY store, a big DIY store, you can buy LED sight lights.
So the sort of thing that when you say sight lights on a building site,
yeah, exactly. They're really quite good. You know, they're not expensive. You know, they're quite rugged. So you know, you can stick them in a plastic box at the end of your photo shoot, and they'll be fine.
And the colour of the light, I suppose, is quite important because the LED.
Well, we can get back to colour in a moment, but the colour is consistent, and that's the more important thing. It's predictable, so you can do something about it. If you have a little bit more budget, then maybe four lights is the best, because four lights means that you can have two on either side, and with those four lights, you'll get a really even exposure. But, you know, the whole expenditure there would be probably only maybe £80 in order to buy the four lights. They're not that pricey.
So what about the use of daylight? Because, you know, surely daylight's a really good light to be photographing your work.
Daylight is lovely. If what you're trying to do is to get a lovely looking light, but if you're trying to get a really even light... It's a nightmare to work with. It changes colour constantly. You know, the middle of the day, the light is a completely different colour to how it's going to be in the late afternoon or in the morning.
If it's a cloudy day or a clear day, that
exactly
affects the way
so.
The light is diffused and bounces.
Now, so actually, a cloudy day is best because on a cloudy day, you get lovely diffuse light. And on a sunny day, when you might think, oh, plenty of light to work with, the light is so contrasting.
So nice. A cloudy day is a good day if you...
Oh, I dream of cloudy days. So much easier to take good pictures on a cloudy day.
So should you, if you're using your sight lights to photograph your work, should you be blocking all the daylight out of the room when you're doing it?
Well, the simple thing to do is to shoot in the evening. It's easier
okay,
to do
so
that.
Okay, so you just wait till it's dark and then...
Or if you've a room where you can subdue the light, that's fine. But what you will need to do is to figure out a way of positioning the lights nicely either side of the picture. Ideally, they need to be roughly at 45 degrees to the artwork. So with you square on to the picture in front of you, the lights need to be either side, pointing diagonally across the picture from either side.
Is that more likely to stop things like glare or kind of shine?
Yeah. What we haven't talked about is how the artwork should look. It's absolutely essential that you photograph your artwork before it's framed.
So before it goes behind glass if it's a 2D
work? Yeah, I mean, absolutely before it's glazed, because if you put glass in front of it, you will regret it.
I think that was a bugbear of Nick Bentley, who we interviewed in a previous episode as a gallerist about photographs of art that came to his gallery. So is there, given the sight lights admittedly aren't hugely expensive, but if you're really on a tight budget, is it possible to improvise with something a bit cheaper than £80?
Well, the £80 was if you were going to go out and buy four of them, and that really would be the ideal. But you could make do with two. That would be fine. And if you really don't want to spend any money at all, then you can just use a couple of ordinary household side lights, you know, something that you might have in your living room. The important thing is that they should match.
So the same bulb in both?
They should be the same bulb. Okay. Ideally, you want something reasonably strong, because the stronger it is, the
easier... So take the lampshade off then.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. But taking the lampshade off, that does lead me on to another thing, which is that you need a nice quality of light.
What does that mean?
Well, I talked just now about sunlight being too contrasty, and what you need to do is to make the light source as big and as diffuse as possible. The bigger a light source is, the less it will cast hard shadows. So a big light source will wrap around the subject, whereas a small light source will produce a very hard light, which will show up every single shadow
And you really don't want shadows
in this instance.
Is that why photographers kind of use those almost like their umbrellas, don't they, to kind of bounce the light?
Exactly. Or, yeah. So some photographers use umbrellas, some use things called soft boxes, which is a big silvered box, silvered on the inside with a pale fabric front on it, which is translucent and it lets the light out. It's really nice and diffuse. But you can achieve the same effect with a sheet of layout paper or tracing paper, even a thin white sheet, as long as it's white.
Yeah.
Don't you go using those satin pink sheets. It won't work at all. So if you suspend a piece of white fabric or tracing paper or layout paper over the front of the lights, about 15 centimetres, 6 inches or so in front of the bulbs, then on the other side of the paper, what you end up with is just a big square light source. And that will give you a much more forgiving light to photograph with. So that's the cheaper way of doing it. It's just to use ordinary
household lights.
So you don't
need to rush out and invest in soft boxes or things like that.
If you can afford it, fine. you probably won't regret it, because it's so much easier to use. But, you know, it isn't essential.
But you could just press a couple of your kids into holding sheets in front of the light.
Yeah. As long as you've got enough kids.
Yeah. Okay, so let's spend some time talking about the sort of 2D artwork, the best way to photograph that. So is it best to photograph it on the floor or on the table or on a wall? Is there a set guideline that we can follow to help us photograph them better?
It's a question of what's convenient. If you have a big space, then you may find it easier to do it on the floor. But I think it's unlikely, because getting a camera square on above a piece of artwork that's on the floor is really difficult.
Oh, you have to sort of stand over it, don't you, I suppose?
You do, yeah. And square on is one of the most important things we've got to talk about here, because if the camera isn't square on, the picture will come out in the photograph distorted. So it will become wedge-shaped rather than square. And so if your artwork is on the floor, your camera needs to be dead centre to the piece of artwork above it.
So in your opinion, it's much easier to have it upright on a wall or an easel or something?
It is. Okay. Now, the only thing that's easier on the floor is that it might be easier to light it if it's flat on the floor.
Yeah.
But getting the camera in position is so much more difficult. I think that outweighs it, really.
Okay. So as someone who has real trouble, as poor Ben, my framer, knows, getting anything straight, how do you go about getting your picture straight on the wall and straight to the camera?
Well, I'm terribly old school. And one of the techniques that always used to be used in the past was to get a sheet of newspaper and tape the newspaper up to the wall where your photograph, where your artwork is going to be. Newspapers are laid out in a grid, and it's really easy to line up your camera if you've got a grid. Most cameras, whether they're compact cameras or SLR cameras or even mobile phones, they have a system where you can switch on a grid on the screen so that you can use that grid to help you line up the newspaper in the screen. And once you've got the camera lined up square to the newspaper, then you just take the newspaper down and put the picture up instead and take your picture. But it's way, way easier to get square on to something big like a newspaper than it would be to if you've got a fairly small photo painting to photograph, for instance.
And are you using a tripod or are you holding the camera?
Well, again, there's an ideal way and then there's the improvised way. I've been a photographer for so long, I have five or six different tripods that I use for various different purposes. But I know that's not realistic, and a decent tripod is quite an investment. So if you don't have another use for a tripod, then you don't need to have a tripod, no. I've produced perfectly usable photographs from a camera propped on a stack of books on a table in front of my carefully positioned artwork. What I would say is that if you want fine adjustment of where the camera is pointing at, then what can help is using a beanbag. And when I say a beanbag, actually a bag of rice is the easiest thing to use, just straight from the supermarket. You put that on top of your stack of books, and then you can make fine adjustments of where the camera is pointing, and the camera will pretty much stay put.
That's a brilliant idea.
That is a really good
idea. I'm
going to
go home and stuff a sock now full of rice and sort of use that as a little mini beanbag. Isn't it?
Well, you can use a sock if you like, but, you know, a plastic bag of rice from Tesco's is just as good.
Actually, while we're talking about basics, can I just put in a plea? Because I made this mistake a couple of days ago. If you're using a phone, do clean the lens. I've just taken a load of rather soft focus photographs because I had lip salves on my fingers and then I touched the photo lens.
Yeah, making sure your photographic equipment is clean is a good idea.
I always forget with a mobile phone as well, because of course it often lives in a pocket or a bag,
exactly.
And of course it picks up lint and dust, so always remember
to
just quickly wipe it off before I take the photograph.
Yeah, that is a very important thing. I've also improvised when using a mobile phone. There are devices available that you can buy to hold a mobile phone like a tripod, but if you just get some cardboard and make a kind of L-shaped device out of cardboard, you can tape your mobile phone to it and that will hold it in place. There's actually a photograph of that in the article that we're going to publish on the show notes.
Oh yeah, that's
notes.
Right. We're going to publish an article on this with photographs of all the improvisations that we're mentioning here.
You
so
see,
that'll be on our show notes.
What we haven't mentioned is that I know some of this stuff was included in an article that Laura and I wrote for Artists and Illustrators magazine some years ago. And so I took some photographs of some of the solutions that I'd come up with.
So we'll make sure that you can access those.
You'll be able to see those. Artists and Illustrators have very kindly allowed us to use it.
So we've got it. We've got the picture on the wall, and we've got the lighting and the camera to take the photograph. But getting the colours right, I'm really nervous about that. How do you go about that?
Well, when I was first learning about photography, the way that this was done was to use. But this was a long time ago, back in the days when it was film. And
you
do really
over your head. Those,
no, not quite that long ago,
okay,
Peter. In the distant past, with film, you had to get it right with filtration. So you either had to use lighting that was really, really accurate, or you had to use a thing called a colour meter, which was a device that measured whether the light was very warm or very cool or very green or very magenta, and then use a load of filters. And that was really complex and terribly expensive. Now, with digital photography, life is so, so much easier. Because with digital photography, you can alter the colour very, very easily. But in order to alter it accurately, you need a reference in your photograph that you absolutely know the colour of. And that can be something that you know to be pure white, or even better, something that is grey, but absolutely neutral grey. Neutral grey is, in photographic terms, it used to be called 18% grey, and I'm not quite sure where the 18% came from.
It's very specific.
But it's a very specific grey, and when you point your camera at it, if you're using a camera rather than a phone, your camera is likely to have a thing called auto white balance or custom white balance. And all you need to do is to find out in the instructions of your camera how that works. And if you put something grey in the picture, then you point the camera at that grey thing and you make a reference shot that basically sets the white balance. And then everything after that that you shoot will come out the right colour.
So where do we find this magic piece of 18% grey?
I think there's a search engine called Googler or something like that anyway.
So you can actually just download and print out?
No, you can't. This is a physical thing.
All right, so you have to buy...
You would need to buy one. However, use a sheet of photocopier paper... You know, as long as it's white.
Yeah. All right, but if I'm in pursuit of this piece of grey, you can actually buy a card with grey printed on it that's the right colour.
Yes, time and inflation seem to have caught up with the mid grey, the 18% grey, and now sometimes they're called 50% greys. But
are they 50% more expensive? This isn't an expensive thing.
There are a number of different things you can get. There's a thing called a Q13 card, or a number of different manufacturers produce grey reference cards. And any one of them will get you an awful lot closer to accurate colour than just using the auto white balance on the camera. And these grey reference cards, they shouldn't cost you more than £5 or £10 at the very most.
Okay, so it's not a huge investment, and it will make things easier.
No, that's right. It's all about just having something to refer to, or for your camera rather, to refer to, in order to know what the colours are in relation to that grey. Now, if you're really into photography, you may have a copy of Photoshop or Lightroom, and within those programs, you can use a reference tool to tell the program where that grey is, and then you don't need to use the custom white balance at all. You can just shoot the picture, not worry about it, and then afterwards in your computer, you can just say, well, that was grey, and it will fix the colour for you immediately.
Well, that takes us very nicely, I think, to post-production, because is there an element where you can sort of edit and change or crop these pictures to kind of make them really fit once you've taken a photo, especially if there's a tiny something wrong with it? Is it okay to edit it appropriately?
I would say that really you should avoid doing anything in post-production if you can. There are one or two things that you may feel are acceptable, but what you mustn't do is to improve the artwork, because really you're producing a photograph to let other people see what that artwork was like. And if you change things to make them better than the original was, then you're treading on very, very dodgy ground.
Can I just interrupt? There is one honourable exception I can think of here, and we will cover it in another episode, but greetings cards. If you're going to produce greetings cards of your work, then this rule doesn't apply because you may want to improve things for a greetings card. But that's very different from what we're talking about, which is copy work for a true reproduction of the artwork.
Absolutely. Now, Photoshop or other photo editors, they are incredibly powerful tools. And if you make mistakes in shooting the pictures, then some of those errors can be fixed. You know, if you don't get absolutely square on to the picture, then you can square it up in Photoshop or in Lightroom. If you get the colour wrong, you can fix it. If you get the lighting uneven from side to side, you can correct it. All of these things are possible, but it's much easier, actually, just to get it right in the picture taking. Mm. Because if you take the picture and then rely on Photoshop to fix it, you're going to spend quite a lot of time in front of your computer screen.
I mean, there may be people out there thinking, oh, golly, this sounds like a big faff. But it is actually a key and crucial part of being an artist, this being able to show people what you've done accurately and well.
You're just doing a disservice to yourself otherwise.
You are. And I think it's really important to get that across, because virtually everyone I speak to in terms of galleries and things, they all sigh and say, oh, there's always, you know, a few artists who send in rubbish photos. And it's really off-putting.
You're also limiting your possibility to allow, you know, galleries and other people to market your work, because you know, if you're providing them with a good image, they themselves will promote your work and say, look what's just arrived in this gallery using that excellent photo you've taken.
But also you might need photos to apply to bid for a stand in a craft fair or show, or to go in for a competition, things like that. And it can make, you know, it's a make or break, really, isn't it?
So I think there's another hidden benefit to having good photography, and that's that when you submit good photographs to a gallery, to a competition, to whoever, people will recognise them as good photographs and you will be taken more seriously as an artist.
That's a very good point.
And if you deliver photographs which are inferior, which are out of focus, which have camera shake, which are the wrong colour, you know, anything like that, people will just think, well, they don't really care very much about the way they present themselves. Mm. And I think that's it's a shame to allow something which is surmountable to stand in your way. No, it just takes a little practice to get significantly better at photography.
Or you could marry a photographer. that's quite a good plan.
Do you have any advice or suggestions on way that I can organise or sort of archive my photos? Because I've got files and files of photographs, and some are different sort of memory, and some are big files and some are small files. As a professional photographer, are there some good rules or suggestions you can give me to kind of be a little bit more organised?
This is slightly difficult because everybody does it differently. Be organised, that's the first one, and be organised right from the beginning, because when you've got 10,000 images on your computer, you won't want to change your filing system because it just takes too long. But what I would say is that for 99% of the uses that the photographs of your work are going to be put to, you only need two file sizes. And when I say file sizes, I mean two different resolutions. This is getting into an area where some people may start throwing up their hands and worrying that they just don't understand. But there are two...
That'll be people like me.
There are two different elements to the resolution of a photograph in the digital world. One is the number of image elements per inch, and that's the one called DPI. And the other one is how many elements in total your picture has. So the DPI, if you're going to use the pictures on a screen, doesn't need to be very high. And typically it will be 72 DPI. That means that for an inch of computer screen, there are 72 dots across. Mm-hmm. But if you print on a printer, or if you send to a publisher for print in on paper a file that is 72 DPI, then it'll come out looking really pixelated, tiny little squares, but quite noticeable. And for print, you would typically want 300 DPI.
It's a lot more quality in image information.
So is this where high res and low res comes
in? Well, sort of, but it goes slightly beyond that, because you can have an image which is 72 DPI, but when reproduced is as big as a billboard.
Mm.
Or you can have an image which is 300 DPI, which when reproduced is the size of a postage stamp. So the other element of your resolution is how big the file is when it is reproduced at the DPI that's specified in the file. So what we tend to do is we use 300 DPI for print, and we allow the file to be as big as it comes out of the camera. So for my camera, that would be around 6,000 pixels across. And then for publication on screen, we produce a second file, and the second file is 1,000 pixels across and is 72 DPI. Now, that means that it will reproduce beautifully on pretty much any computer screen.
But that's quite useful, isn't it, in case anyone wants to use that picture themselves and print it out. Having a lower resolution keeps your picture safe?
It is slightly more secure. If you're publishing things online and you
don't... I'm thinking of social media particularly.
Yeah, if you publish things only at 72 DPI, 1,000 pixels across, if somebody prints that out themselves on their home printer, the quality won't be great, but it'll look super on the screen.
Mm.
And that, you know, that does help
kind of
to preserve your security.
So if I was looking to make sort of, you know, prints of my painting, sort of reproductions, I've definitely got to work with that higher quality.
Absolutely.
Resolution image.
Yeah. Absolutely. I store those files in separate folders. So I have a high-res folder where I store my big files and a low-res folder where I store my
small files.
And we store
by title of picture as well.
Yeah.
It's a good idea when if you are sending images to people to label them with your name and the picture title. Mm. Makes it much easier.
And I would say that if you're just starting out in taking digital photos, then having a serious think about a logical filing system or naming convention for your photographs, where there are bits of information embedded in the name of the file, that really helps when you're looking for stuff later on.
Yeah, we wish we'd done that from the beginning,
but we've kind of evolved. I mean, I have files and files and files of digital information on my computer. There are probably 100,000 photographs on my computer, and because I have so much, I find it very difficult sometimes to put my hands on something quickly.
So we've talked so far really about two-dimensional photography, the photographing of prints and paintings and drawings, things like that. But what we haven't talked about are 3D items. Is that a whole other ball game?
That is a whole other ball game. I was kind of hoping that this subject wouldn't come up because it's so much more difficult. So with 3D work, the situation is completely different, because with sculpture, with ceramics, even with textiles, if these are textiles made up into garments or into 3D artworks, with glass work, with silver, and with carpentry and carved wood and things like that, the way that light falls on the subject is absolutely crucial to the way that you appreciate it. It's aesthetics. It's all about surface and texture and all of those things.
So the photography is playing a slightly different role here.
An absolutely different role. In fact, in a way, it's the absolute reverse of what you would want to do for 2D work. And if you go to 5 different photographers or 50 different photographers and ask each of them to photograph a 3D piece of work, they'll come up with 50, with 5 or 50 different versions of an appropriate photograph. And there's nothing really to say which of those is right. It's more a question of which of those fulfills your requirement as an artist in promoting your work. Mm.
One thing I would say, and I think Nick Bentley mentioned it, was that galleries like not just the whole object, but also some close-up details of the object when it comes to 3D work, so they can actually see the surface of the subject.
I would agree with that, and learning to get up close and personal with 3D work, get really close and photographing whether it's sculptural details or surface details or patina, if it's a piece of patinated metal, or chisel marks, if it's a piece of carved wood, any of those things.
Because there's a tactile nature to it, 3D work, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. My speciality has always been to do with ceramics. And if I don't have control over the lighting and I want to photograph a pot, my tendency is to get very close. Mm. Because you can take fascinating photographs of pieces of 3D work just by getting really in close, personal with it, and highlighting the surface texture. But it's not something that is quite as straightforward as in terms of having a formulaic way of doing it, because each piece of artwork will require a different
result. So it would be fair to say that you need to experiment and decide on the kind of lighting you like and arrive at photographing 3D work to suit yourself.
Absolutely. And I would say that that some of the rules that one might have about photographing 2D work, you could absolutely turn on their head if you're photographing sculpture, because sometimes it will be right to have hard, contrasty lighting.
Or daylight, natural
light. Or natural daylight.
Or even outside if it's a sculpture.
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, sometimes you won't have a choice, because sometimes the sculpture will be in situ. And, you know, if it's in situ outside, that's where you're going to have to photograph it.
Go and trundle a big bronze into the studio.
Well, thank you very much, Ben, for sharing all of your insight and knowledge. You can get back behind the away from the mic now and see if you can edit it all together.
Oh, I'm so pleased. Thank you. It's been fun.
So, Peter, what's our takeaway for this week?
Well, I think it's clear that a good photograph of your artwork offers the very first impression of both your art and professionalism. So it really does pay to get it right first time. And remember that thanks to Artist and Illustrator magazine, there will be a full illustrated guide on how to photograph your artwork correctly found on our website, askanartistpodcast.com.
Thank you so much for listening and for all those great reviews and ratings that you've been leaving for us. We do love them and we read them all. If you haven't rated or reviewed us yet, please do so. It helps with the show and it keeps us making new episodes.